It's November 2019, and I'm going to take you inside a courtroom in Tallahassee, Florida. It's not the first time prosecutors are trying the defendant, 41-year-old Henry Segura, for murder. His first trial, back in July 2017, ended in a mistrial after 19 hours of juror deliberations, and now prosecutors were trying him again. The state of Florida says that Henry Segura committed a horrible, brutal, unspeakable murder.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, when you put together the motive, the means, the deception, the opportunity, the DNA, you're left with one conclusion.
They say Henry murdered his son's mother, along with her three children, one of the children being his son. On November 20th, 2010, Tallahassee police responded to a house on Saddle Creek Run after a neighbor reported seeing blood when he went to knock on the door. It was the home of 27-year-old Brandy Peters and her three children, 6-year-old twins Tamaya and Tanaya, and 3-year-old Javante. All four were found deceased inside the house. 10 months later, at a lake house on Lake Jefferson in Minnesota, Henry Segura was arrested and charged with the murders. At his retrial, prosecutor John Fuchs spoke to the jury for about 34 minutes in his opening statements. He succinctly laid out the evidence they were going to present against Henry and told the jury that he was guilty, which would make him eligible for the death penalty if they chose to convict him. But when it was the defense's turn, Henry's attorney came out swinging.
You won't hear any dispute from the defense that this is the most heinous offense that's, you know, been committed in Tallahassee. There isn't any argument against that. The problem is that it wasn't Mr. Segura.
He said it was actually a killing orchestrated and carried out by the Mexican cartel. And furthermore, someone involved with the cartel actually confessed to it.
Mr. Santos will testify in this trial. Mr. Santos will admit to you that he ordered the murders, that he orchestrated the murders.
At the end of it all, the jury would have to decide if the defendant before them murdered Brandy Peters and her three children. Was her child's father the killer, or was it really the Mexican cartel? Stay tuned for what might be one of the most head-scratching cases I've ever covered. This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 117.
What the evidence is going to show you is that Henry Segura is responsible for the murder.
Prosecutor John Fuchs detailed for the jury what the investigation into the murders looked like. He said investigators looked into everyone Brandy knew to question them and to see if they could perhaps provide any leads as to who would have wanted to hurt Brandy and her kids. They spoke to Henry Segura, primarily at first so they could notify him that his son was dead. As part of their normal protocol, he was asked where he was when the murders occurred. Henry said he was at home and told them they could check his cell phone records to verify that. They interviewed him again and discovered that he had a second cell phone that he didn't tell them about.
You're going to hear throughout the course of this that he was interviewed by Tallahassee Police Department on two different occasions, days apart. First one was to notify them of the death of his son. And the second was follow-up. And what he did is he lied to law enforcement. He said, I was not there. I was at home the entire time. Tallahassee Police Department did their investigation, realized he was lying, called him in for a second interview to clarify. I was at home all the time. Checked my cell phone records. They say I was there. But he made a mistake. He thought he could pull one over the eyes of the Tallahassee Police Department. What they did is they found out he had a separate phone number that he didn't tell them about.
Fuchs said the phone records from the second phone showed that he was near Brandy's house when they believed the murders occurred. Investigators also worked to establish a timeline. They found out that Brandy always had her cell phone on her, that she was constantly using her phone. She was last seen the night before the bodies were found, and the last text she responded to was at 6:53 p.m. At 8:21 p.m., her phone was shut down and never turned back on again. Fuchs said they can't hammer down the exact time she was killed, but that within a couple hours of her death, she and the kids had eaten. He estimated the murders occurred between 6:53 p.m. and 8:21 p.m. Fuchs told the jury that the murder weapon was most likely a .32 caliber pistol, and that it appeared as though someone used the wrong kind of bullets. Fuchs told the jury to ask themselves who had one and didn't know how to use it. Fuchs said the call records from Henry's second phone show that it made several calls to Brandy on the day of the murder, and that each time, *67 had been used before dialing. Pressing *67 before making a call allows you to hide the number from which you're calling. At 11:30 a.m., the number called Brandy and they spoke for 56 minutes. The number called Brandy again at 1:18 and 1:28. At 2:13 p.m., the number called again, and this call lasted for 2 minutes and 35 seconds. At 2:19, Brandy sent a text message to Henry's first cell phone that said, "You hang up on me?"
He hung up on me? What does that tell you? 2:19, they fighting? On day of the murder?
Then there was another call to Brandy's cell phone from that number, again using *67. As for the motive, Fuchs said it involved money. Henry was behind on his child support payments, he said, a little over $20,000. He said after all is said and done, the jury will be left with one conclusion, that Henry committed this murder. Henry's attorney, Nate Prince, attacked the prosecution's theory of motive first. He said that yes, Henry owed Brandy about $20,000 in child support for Javonte. But what the state doesn't know is that Henry had already gone through this similar situation with someone else. Another mother of another one of his children. That mother had obtained a judgment against him for an identical amount years ago, which was still in place. He had already dealt with this, Prince said.
It's kind of difficult for me to articulate this, but Mr. Segura's quote is probably most apt, which is that there ain't no black man anywhere in America killing somebody over child support. That's just not something that happens. It's something that he says culturally, just deal with. You know how to deal with. Nobody's killing anybody over child support.
He said the state is going to point to text messages earlier in the week before her murder, where Brandy tells Henry he's a deadbeat and how she's going to put him in jail. But Prince said there was a change in tone in the text messages to Henry prior to the murder. On Wednesday, 2 days before the murders, Henry went over to Brandy's house to talk. He explains how he had been injured. He was shot in July 2010, and he hadn't been able to work for some time, and so he was behind on all sorts of payments.
And so he basically goes over there and talks to Brandy and cools her down, and the best evidence of that are Brandy's own words, because on Thursday, we see that Brandy sends Mr. Segura a text message saying, "Hey, you were looking good yesterday. If you weren't my baby daddy, I would have given you some," clearly indicating that the meeting on Wednesday went well.
Prince conceded that Henry is a well-known philanderer, even though he's been married to his wife Malika for 12 years. He said he had a son with another woman about a year and a half prior to the murders, and that the son was born prematurely and passed away. After that happened, he promised Malika that he wouldn't run around on her anymore. But he didn't hold to that, Prince said, and he continued to cheat on her, including with Brandy. Prince told the court that there are other people who had the motive to murder Brandy, and said one of those people is James Carlos Santos, a drug trafficker and member of the Vice Lords. He said Santos brought Brandy in as a drug mule a few years ago, and that he would work with the cartel to bring drugs to the border. Brandy would then act as a mule for him. At some point, Santos became aware that Brandy was lifting a significant amount of drugs off of the deliveries. Prince told the jury that they will hear directly from Santos, that he will testify, and will admit that he ordered and orchestrated the murders.
His face isn't clean, as the term goes. His face isn't clean until and unless he specifically takes care of the problem, because he's the one who brought Brandy in. He's the one who's responsible for her. So not only does he have to take care of the problem, He has to be sure that his cartel associates know that he's the one who took care of the problem.
Prince told the jury that Santos recruited a man named Haywood Griffin to carry out the hit. And Griffin enlisted the help of a man named Demario Paramore. A confidential informant with the police then recorded a conversation with Paramore, who admitted that he helped carry out the murders. Prince said he will call a cartel expert to the stand, who will testify about how one of the things cartels will do when they kill someone is to leave a calling card. Prince said that happened in this case, that there was a spade or a shovel found by Brandy's body. There was no blood on it, he said, so it wasn't used in the murder. It was just placed there afterwards. As for DNA, Prince said there was none of Henry's DNA found at the crime scene. However, he said there's plenty of foreign DNA found on items relevant to the case. One item is a landline phone that was in Brandy's bedroom. He said it was ripped out of the phone jack and that the cord was cut. One of the people that Santos will tell you was involved in the murder, he said, is Angel Avilas, a Colombian national and drug trafficker. His DNA was found on that phone, Prince told the jury. Foreign male DNA was also found on the shovel next to Brandy's body.
So we've got DNA on the phone cradle that matches Mr. Avila. We've got foreign male DNA on the shovel placed next to the victim's body. Mr. Segura, by the way, is excluded as a contributor to the foreign male DNA found on the shovel. We also have foreign female DNA found under the victim's fingernail. And one of the things that you'll see is that Brandy Peters fought valiantly in this case for herself and for her children to the point where all her knuckles are broken and bruised and her acrylic nails have been ripped off. And under those fingernails was found foreign female DNA. The reason that that's relevant is that Dr. Dela Cruz will tell you that a general cartel tactic is to send a female. If they're going to do a hit at somebody's house, they'll send a female to the door because they're less threatening and more likely to get access. And Mr. Santos will tell you that's what happened here, that a female was sent to the door when Brandy saw the rest of the folks coming. That's when she ran inside.
Prince then addressed a cleanup scene about a quarter mile from Brandy's house. About a week after the murders, a trash can was discovered that had been set on fire. Inside were bloody latex gloves, an empty towel box, a gallon of bleach, and bloody shirts. He said there was foreign male DNA that excluded Henry on those shirts. Prince told the jury that Henry was a contributor to DNA found on the bath bar in the bathroom of the home, where the three children were found. But the reason his DNA is there, Prince said, is because it was actually his son Javante's DNA. Javante was included as a contributor. Prince said the state's theory is that Henry committed the murders by himself, but he said there were 5 shoe impressions found near Brandy's body, which was indicative of at least 5 people being involved. The defense also believes the prosecution's timeline is wrong, that the evidence indicates that Brandy and her kids were actually killed later. Prince said they know that Brandy was still alive when her phone died at 8:21 p.m. She ran for the landline when she was being attacked, he said, noting the struggle over that phone. And according to Prince, Brandy's sister Monica told police the day after the murders that she last spoke to Brandy at about 10 p.m. the night before. Prince said Henry's cell phone records for that second phone do show that he was at Brandy's house the day of the murder. And that's because he was, he said. Brandy's text to Henry about how he looked good when he came over the day before set things into motion, and they started flirting again. He said Henry was using Star 67 to call Brandy, but that was because he didn't want her to have the number to his second phone, the phone he used to call his girlfriends. She's one of those people that blows your phone up, he said. He said Henry went over to Brandy's house around 3:30 p.m. on the day of the murders and parked at a church by her house. The reason he did that is because every time he and Brandy hooked up, he didn't want to park in her driveway. He said he didn't want his wife to find out. According to Prince, Henry and Brandy had sex, and then he hung out for a little while. They watched TV, and he ultimately left around 8:20 p.m. His phone records show he then traveled back to his house, got there around 9:30 p.m., and stayed there for the rest of the night. Prince said Henry did lie to police about being there that night, but only because he was cheating on his wife and didn't want her to find out.
One thing that I would ask you to keep your ears open for and pay attention to when you hear this testimony come out, Mr. Segura didn't tell any lies during his police interviews that were unique to Brandy, which is extraordinarily important. When he's asked about Natasha Hawthorne, another one of his girlfriends, he lies about her too and says that he's friends with her, that he's not hooking up with her. And Investigator Lewis kind of pokes him about that and asks about that. And no, she's just a friend. So he's not only lying about Brandy, he's lying about every woman with whom he's having an extramarital affair.
Prince told the jury it's important to keep in mind the lack of evidence. There's no evidence of blood transfer and no evidence of injuries. He showed the jury a photo of Henry taken the day after the murders. No cuts, no scratches, nothing on him. There was only a tiny little scratch on his arm, he said. He noted that the attacker would have been covered in blood, but there was no blood transfer found anywhere in Henry's vehicle or on any of his clothes.
I know I've just kind of thrown a lot at you, but I wanted to give you a thorough preview of what I expect the evidence to be so that you can, number one, be aware of what's coming and think about ahead of time how all that evidence fits together.
He said the state will fail to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt, and he asked the jury to find Henry Segura not guilty. Artron Timmons was 14 years old in 2010. He lived with his mom and stepfather across the street from Brandy Peters. Brandy and his mom were friends. On the morning of November 20th, 2010, his mom called him from work and told him that Brandy's mom had called her and was trying to get a hold of Brandy but couldn't. She asked him to go over there and tell Brandy to call her mom. He walked across the street, and two houses down to be exact. As he was walking up the driveway, he saw what looked like blood drops on the ground. He went to ring the doorbell, but the doorbell was pushed in. He couldn't ring it. Artron testified that he thought maybe one of the kids had hurt themselves, but then he looked up and saw blood all over the curtains. As he looked inside the window, he could see blood everywhere. He knocked on the door, but no one answered. He went home, called his mom, and told her what he saw. He then called the police. Artron told the jury that he saw Brandy and the kids the night before, between 5 and 6 p.m. He said they were playing in between his house and his neighbor's house, and they had left Burger King wrappers in his yard. He said he recalls his stepfather cooking some oxtail soup for the kids and for Brandy. That was roughly between 6 and 7 p.m. Officer Candace Jernigan responded to Brandy's home around 10 a.m. after Artron Timmons had called the police. She, too, observed what looked like a large amount of blood on the exterior of the house, on the front door and on the garage. She immediately wondered if something might still be going on inside the home, so she cleared some of the neighborhood kids who had been playing nearby and tried to keep them away. She testified that she called for backup and walked around the house, looking in the windows and listening for any possible noises. She made her way to the back of the house and saw a body when she looked through the back door.
A leg, a human leg, sticking out, laying on the floor, sticking out from behind a couch.
Your training experience, did that stand out to you?
Yes, obviously. I thought somebody was hurt or had been hurt. The leg wasn't moving, appeared still.
All doors and windows appeared to be locked, and she could see no signs of forced entry. She said there was a screen that was a little wonky, but the window itself was closed and locked. Her backup was almost there, so she took cover while she waited for them to arrive. Officer Derek Kidd arrived and used his baton to break open a front window. He reached in and saw that the bolt and the handle were locked. He opened them and then called out for anyone to make a noise if they were there, but there was silence. They saw a female lying on the floor when they entered the home. They cleared the front and Officer Sean Wyman joined them. They made their way through the house, and when they came upon the main bathroom, Officer Wyman saw bodies in the bathtub.
I remember that it was really dark when I went in. I flipped the light switch. I walk in, there's a bathtub basically right there in front of me. And I'll never forget, I saw two deceased juveniles in the tub. And it's not, the part that I remember the most was that I saw them, I called it on the radio, and then I immediately just walked back out like it was nothing, because I was in this mode of need to make sure that there's nobody in the house that's going to hurt us or hurt anybody else, and make sure that there's nobody else that's actually hurt.
He initially thought there were only two bodies in the bathtub, but later found that there were actually three, all three of the children. Crime scene tape was put up around the house while officers waited for the crime scene unit to arrive. Annie Williams, a forensic investigator, testified that the back door was locked, the bottom handle, but not the deadbolt. There were lights on in the main bathroom and also in Javonte's bedroom. Those were the only lights on in the house. The TV was on in the master bedroom, as well as in the twin girls' bedroom. In the master bedroom were several bullet holes. A wallet was on the bed, and it looked like the items had been taken out of the wallet and laid out. There was a purse on the floor just below the bed. The wall jack from the phone had been broken off, and the broken piece was still in the wall. The phone and cord were on the floor. There were bullet holes in the master bath, too. The window in the master bath had exterior screen damage, and the window was in the unlocked position. That was the only window that was unlocked in the entire house. Williams testified that there was nothing of evidentiary value found in the twins' bedroom, but there were several areas of blood on the outside of Javonte's bedroom door. In the main bathroom, the bodies of all three children were stacked on top of each other in the bathtub. Williams said she collected fingernail scrapings from under Brandy's fingernails, along with swabs from her neck, hands, and ears. She dusted for prints on various parts of the home, but only found two latent prints of value, in the main bathroom, on the faucet where the water comes out, and on the interior garage door handle. Crime scene investigators would later learn that the print on the faucet was from Brandy, and the print on the interior garage door handle was not a match for neither Brandy or Henry. The jury asked why Williams didn't process the back door for fingerprints, and she said there was no particular reason, but she didn't have an answer as to why they didn't. Brandy was very close to her mom and her sister, Monica. The three of them would talk on a daily basis, and Monica and her mom were very active in Brandy's kids' lives. In fact, the twins were supposed to stay at her mom's house the night the murders occurred. There was a period of time when Monica actually lived with Brandy and the kids for a few months. She testified that they usually ate dinner around 5 or 6 p.m. She was asked by the prosecutor if she was aware of any damage to any of Brandy's window screens, and she said yes. She had noticed a rip in one of them in the master bedroom. It had been like that since Brandy moved in, she said. Brandy lived in Section 8 housing. She had a Pontiac Grand Prix, but it was broken down and had been for a while, so she often used her mom's car to get around. However, earlier in the week before her murders, that car had broken down too. On November 19th, Brandy was supposed to come and pick up Monica's daughter. She never showed. She tried to call Brandy around 9 p.m., but her phone kept going to voicemail. Their mom tried calling Brandy around 9 or 10. And couldn't get a hold of her either. Monica told the court that Brandy always had her phone on her. She said Brandy's home phone was disconnected at the time, so she never bothered trying to call her on that. Monica eventually went to sleep that night, but she kept trying to call Brandy when she woke up the next morning. After her mom called her about what Artron Timmons had seen at the house, she threw her kids in the car and raced over. She saw blood all over the door. On cross, Prince asked Monica about what she told officers when she interviewed with them after the murders. He asked her if she had told them that she last spoke to Brandy at 10 p.m. Monica said no, she doesn't recall saying that, and she may have said that she tried to call Brandy then, but not that she talked to her. She said she knows for a fact that she didn't talk to her then. Brandy Peters had been shot 7 or 8 times, including one shot to the back of her head. The gunshots, however, didn't immediately kill her, and Dr. Lisa Flanagan, the medical examiner who examined the bodies, said that she still would have been functioning and able to run after being shot. But there was also blunt force trauma to her head, which cracked her skull. According to Dr. Flanagan, Brandy tried to fight off the attack and was beaten repeatedly with a heavy object.
I ruled the cause of death as blunt traumatic injuries of the head and face and multiple gunshot wounds. The main cause would be the impacts to her head with the injuries, obviously the open wound on the face, but all the traumatic injuries of the brain.
Dr. Flanagan said the series of impacts to Brandy's face were at the end of the attack. She said she can't determine a time of death, only that it occurred within a few hours of her last meal due to the contents of her stomach. She didn't see any signs of sexual assault. Dr. Flanagan also testified about the causes of death for the children. Tamaya had been shot in the back of the head, and Tanaya and Javante had died by drowning. On cross, Dr. Flanagan said the injuries on Brandy's head were consistent with that of a gun, but she can't exclude other objects either. Another forensic specialist testified about what the children had been wearing. Tamaya was dressed in a black plaid long sleeve shirt, black pants, red underwear, and white sandals. Tanaya was in a sleeveless shirt with a strawberry print, pink shorts, and white underwear. Javante was wearing gray pants and Spider-Man underwear. Henry Segura was first interviewed on November 20th, just a few hours after the bodies were found. Investigator Mark Lewis testified that they wanted to talk to Henry so they could let him know that his son Javante had died. As for whether Henry was a suspect at that point, Investigator Lewis said no, not at all. No Miranda warning was issued, and he wasn't in custody. The recorded interview started at 7:51 p.m. "You doing okay?" Investigator Lewis asked Henry as he sat down across from him in the interview room. "Yes, sir," Henry replied. Henry gave Investigator Lewis his cell phone number, as well as some of his family members' numbers.
"Do you have any idea why you're here?"
"Yeah. I found out. I'm guessing why. Brandy Peters."
"Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The girl who braids my hair. She braided my son's hair. Her daughter is a godchild to a girl that lives right next door to Brandy. And I'm guessing the girl who braided my hair, her daughter, is some girl that lives next door to Brandy's, her god mom or something like that. So she said that Brandy's mom and them came over to their house and told them this morning. When I called her about getting son's hair, she told me."
"Okay, what'd she tell you?"
"That Brandy and the kids, someone killed them this morning."
"It's true."
Henry said, "That's the second son I've lost." When asked what happened to his other son, he said he just didn't wake up one morning. He was born prematurely and had breathing problems.
"I'm sorry to hear that. And I'm sorry for what happened today. Do you have any idea who would want to hurt these people?"
"Girl Pint, one does my hair. She was saying somebody, they thought my son was with some other guy. And she said that the two girls, the kids, were killed. My son wasn't found in the house. And she said she think that he's with some guy who she's saying is his daddy. And something like that."
"Okay. Let me ask you this.
I'm not sure.
Is Dewan your son?"
"No.
Javante. Is he your son?"
"Yes, sir."
"Okay. How old is Javante?"
"3.
Investigator Lewis told him Javonte was found in the home.
And I'm sorry to tell you, but he has passed away.
Yeah, she told me that they found the girls and the boy wasn't in the house. They think that he's with his dad, or some guy she's claiming was his dad. The girl Pine, who's doing my son's hair. Then she, when I went back over there, she said, no, they did find him in the house.
Investigator Lewis asked him if Javonte is his child, and Henry said yes. He then said there were some paternity issues, but that legally he's his son and has his name. He said Brandy used to tell him that Javonte was another man's son and then kept going back and forth. He went to go get a paternity test, but he didn't have the money to do it. He said they told him it would be $300 or $400. Investigator Lewis asked him if he currently pays child support, and he said he does, but that he hasn't in a while. He hasn't had the money to pay. Bills are backed up, he said. He has another kid he needs to pay child support for, and he hasn't paid that one in a while either. Henry said he has two kids with his wife, Javonte with Brandy, and a daughter in Orlando. He said he used to have five kids total. Henry's wife's name is Malika. He said they've been married for 10 years and been together for 13.
So do you know or do you not know if you're Javonte's father? Like, for sure, do you suspect not, or do you suspect, yeah, he's mine?
I'm not sure.
You're not sure? But since he has your name, he's your son.
Yes, sir.
When asked what kind of person Brandy is, Henry said, spunky. She's down to earth. She's real sweet. She's a cool person, he said. They met at a gas station about 4 years ago. When asked if Malika knew about their relationship, Henry responded, eventually.
I don't have nothing much to say. She caught me on the phone bill one day. Same phone bill, saying I was calling this number a lot. What did that happen?
So she confronts you with a phone bill and says, hey, who's this? What's this all about?
So you're talking on the phone 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning for an hour, 2 hours. This number, it's got to be somebody important.
So did she ever make the phone call, like call a number?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, they used to call each other all the time.
Oh, really? Malika and Brandy?
That was like before the month they was born.
Friends or no? But they're squabble. Yeah. Okay.
She just would tell her, stop messing with me and... Yada, yada, yada.
Henry told Investigator Lewis that he and Brandy stopped talking when Javonte was about 6 months old. Brandy had sent a text message to his wife, and he said he was tired of her being disrespectful. He said his wife doesn't know what Brandy looks like, but that Brandy knew what his wife looked like. He said he was just at Brandy's house this past Wednesday, though, to see Javonte. He said he and Brandy don't have any kind of relationship anymore. He used to go over there all the time, about a year prior, but then he stopped. While he played with Javonte on Wednesday, Brandy was hanging out there too. Henry told Investigator Lewis that he had actually been the one to file paperwork for child support, not Brandy, and that Brandy was cool with it when he wasn't able to pay her. When asked when the last time he spoke to Brandy was, he said he thinks on Thursday, but he said she sent him a text message on Friday, asking what he was doing, but he didn't respond. There were no issues when he found out Brandy was pregnant, he said. He was hoping to have a girl, but that it was cool with him. He was asked how he's feeling now. It hurts, he said, but there's nothing I can do. Investigator Lewis asked him about Brandy's lifestyle and the friends she would hang out with. Henry said they don't talk much, so he isn't sure. He said she has two sisters and would hang out with them a lot. Henry was then asked about his day the day before, on Friday, the day Brandy and her kids were killed. He said he took his two kids to school around 7:30 a.m. He then went to McDonald's and went home. He said he got back between 9:30 and 10 and was then home all day, working on his car. His wife got home around 5:15 and he fell asleep around 10 or so. He said Brandy texted him earlier in the afternoon at about 1:20 or 2:20, but he didn't respond. He said he got up around 8 a.m. and went to Walmart and then to his buddy Silas's house. He got home around 5 p.m. and then agreed to meet with officers.
Just can't figure out why. Why would someone want to kill children? Do you have any idea why someone would want to do that?
I have no idea whatsoever, he said. Henry told him that he said a prayer when he first heard about the murders, that he knows it's going to be hard on the family. He said he knows how hard it is to lose someone like that. In fact, his mom had just called him earlier that day and told him that one of his cousins got shot and killed the night before in Louisiana. Investigator Lewis asked him if he's going to be going to Louisiana for that funeral, and Henry said he doesn't know. It just happened last night. When asked if he's going to go to Javante's funeral, he said yes. As for whether he's going to be responsible for making arrangements, he said he doesn't know. He has to talk to Brandy's mom, but that he's sure he will pay for it. They then sit for a while in silence. At trial, the prosecutor asked Investigator Lewis if Henry had any injuries. He did, Lewis testified. He had scratches on his biceps. The jury was shown four different scratches on Henry's arms. Investigator Lewis testified that during the interview, Henry gave him his cell phone number, as well as the number for his friend Silas, whose house he had gone over to the day after the murders. While investigators were reviewing Brandy's phone records, the number Henry had given them for Silas kept showing up right before her death. Not only that, but the records showed that that phone was in the area of Brandy's house around the time of the murders. At some point, they learned that that number was actually Henry's. It belonged to his second phone, the one he used to contact his girlfriends. They called Henry back in for a second interview about 10 days after the first, on November 30th. This time, he was a potential suspect, and his Miranda rights were read to him. Investigator Lewis was joined by Investigator Johnson. At the start of this interview, Investigator Johnson asked Henry what number he could be reached at. He gave her two numbers, but did not give her the number of his second cell phone. Investigators then focused on Henry's alibi, that he was home all day on the day of the murders. They asked him who could verify that, and he said he doesn't know. His neighbors may have been home. He said his wife had also called him before she left work, so she could verify that too. Other than that, he doesn't know. He told them to check his cell phone records, that it would show that he would be home all day.
And why people say things, I don't know. We talked to a lot of people, and people are saying you weren't home Friday night. And if you happen to go out, see somebody, or to talk to somebody, that's why I'm urging you, you know, it's best that we know ahead of time. That way it doesn't come up later and there's an issue with it, okay? Did you go anywhere at all Friday? You didn't leave your house from the time you woke up to the time you went to bed that night?
I didn't leave the house Friday, I don't leave nothing. Charlie, you remember that Friday? I don't think I left for that.
Didn't she take the kids to school?
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
Investigator Johnson asked him if he went over to Brandy's house at all on Friday. He said no.
Someone seen me at Brandy's house on Friday?
I've got to ask the question.
Okay. Well, I said, I know.
Would somebody tell us that?
I don't know. I've been seeing a bunch of stuff I've been hearing about a bunch of stuff on the news and on the internet, but.
Okay. Like what kind of stuff have you been reading?
Someone said something about I had a key to her house. I couldn't afford to pay the child support, so I killed her before my wife would find out about her, because my wife didn't know about her, and just a bunch of stupid stuff.
Investigator Johnson asked him if he had other ways of communicating with people, and he said he has email. She asked him what his email address is, and he asked why they would want that, as well as why they would want contact information for his friends.
Why? Because We're investigating a homicide.
I didn't have a homicide that I didn't have anything to do with. Okay. A homicide that the people who I know, say people I work with, live in Texas, they don't know Brandy. They don't have any idea about my relationship that I had with Brandy. They don't know her children or her child. What would they have to do with this? That's why I can't figure out, why would you want Adam's phone number? Why would you want my cousin's number in Spring Hill? They don't have anything to do with Brandy, or they don't know anything about our relationship that we had.
But Henry, I already explained this thing to you earlier. I said there is no stone that's being unturned. And you're not the only person that's been confronted with these hard-hitting questions, so to speak.
It's not hard-hitting questions. It's just that I just don't see I don't see where is it going to get you.
I need to know what makes you tick, Investigator Lewis told him. Henry responded that there's nothing that would make him kill Brandy and her kids. He said he doesn't see how his personal lifestyle is relevant to Brandy's murder because they live two totally different personal lifestyles. Nothing goes uncovered, Investigator Lewis told him. The who, what, when, where, how, and whys will be covered. Investigator Johnson then asked Henry what about his second cell phone.
Let me ask you this.
My cooperation.
What's your other cell phone number?
I don't have another cell phone.
You got a second phone?
I don't know.
You do have a second phone. I know you have a second phone. Okay. I'm 100% positive you have a second phone.
He said he had a second phone, but that he threw it away in the dumpster by his house because he doesn't need it anymore. Investigator Johnson asked him who he would talk to on it. He said his female friends. She then asked which females, and he said it's irrelevant, that it was from before Brandy passed away. He then said he was talking to a girl who lived in Atlanta and that she has nothing to do with this. I don't see no reason for you to call her or her family, he said. He said other than that, though, he will help them with whatever they need to help solve the case. Investigator Johnson asked him where he really was on Friday, saying they know that he wasn't at home. Henry didn't budge. Johnson then tried another tactic. She told him that they've talked to many people about Brandy and that she understands that Brandy wasn't the nicest of people. She didn't hold her tongue, didn't have a filter, had no qualms about ruining other people's lives or marriages or relationships with kids, she said. She said they know Brandy only cared about doing what was best for her and what money she was going to get.
I empathize with you. I do.
What you empathize with me for?
Because I can understand the position that you're in, that she placed you in.
I wasn't in no position.
I just
had to pay some child support.
Henry maintained his innocence and maintained that he did not go to Brandy's house that day throughout the interview. The prosecution called two women who dated Henry to the stand. The first, Natasha, had known Henry for about a year in November 2010. She said he had two cell phones that she would talk to him on. She was asked if he ever mentioned Javonte to her, and she said yes. She said at one point he mentioned that there was a child who the mother claimed was his, but that he wasn't sure. She was asked if he told her that the child was murdered, and she said yes. On November 19th, the night of the murders, she said she either got a text message or a call from Henry between 9 and 11 p.m. She said she doesn't recall him telling her that he was anywhere, but she remembers getting the impression that he wasn't at home or that he was headed home. But she doesn't remember, she said. On cross, Natasha said she was in a sexual relationship with Henry at the time of the murders. But when interviewed by police, she too lied and told them they were just friends.
When you're interviewed by the police and you told them y'all were just friends, why was that?
Well, there were a number of reasons, but primarily because he was married.
And do you recall specifically that after his son passed away the year prior, he made a promise to his wife that he wasn't going to run around anymore, so y'all were trying to keep the affair more secret than he had been in the past?
Your Honor, I object to hearsay.
Overruled.
I don't recall that happening because I didn't know him then, but I recall him telling me that, yes.
Kyra was another woman with whom Henry was involved. She said they dated in 2009, but had stopped seeing each other by the time the murders occurred. They were still talking, however. She was asked if Henry's wife knew they were dating, and she said yes. She told her many times. At one point, she said Henry even had her on speakerphone while they were together, and he asked her for a divorce. Just prior to the murders, she said Henry came over to her house and asked if he could use her gun. She told him no because it was registered to her, but that she would let him know if she came across a burner gun. She never came across one. On cross, Tyra was asked if it's true that when she and Henry were on a trip to Savannah together, he threw her and her belongings out of the car. She said yes. She was asked how she then got back home, and she responded, "That's my personal business." She then said a friend brought her back home. Then she said she met a guy there, and he brought her to the bus station.
And it's true that you actually called Mr. Segura's wife while you were in Savannah, correct?
Yes, it is.
And you told Mr. Segura's wife that the two of you were messing around, correct?
Correct. I told him I was going to tell her.
Okay, and that is why he got upset with you, correct?
He was upset before I called him.
Well, he was certainly upset after you called her, right?
Yes.
And that's why he left you in Georgia, correct?
Yes.
Henry's attorney pointed out that after the murders, she didn't call the police, but called Crime Stoppers instead. She said yes, that was true. To this day, Crime Stoppers had not paid her anything, and she had asked an attorney for help with that. One of Henry's friends, Calvin Moore, was a contract firefighter overseas in Afghanistan. He testified that he had talked to Henry about joining him. He told Henry that he could make six figures by going there and working. But in order to do that, he would have to go through an extensive background check. "You can't have large debts or child support," he told the court. He said he told Henry about that. This was months prior to November 2010. When asked if he knew of Henry to own a gun, he said yes. He knew Henry had a .32 revolver, which he estimated that he saw probably in the summer of 2010. Henry's friend Silas Thornton testified too. He said he was a welder with Henry, that they worked on numerous jobs together. On the morning of November 20th, the day after the murders, Henry called him and told him he was in the area. Silas was just waking up. Henry came over and stayed for a while. They shot crossbows, ate lunch, and threw around a football in the front yard. When asked if he had ever seen Henry with a gun, he said yes. They all had guns. He said he has seen him with revolvers and semi-automatics. Silas then told the court about how Henry's second phone had actually been his at one point. He said he doesn't recall exactly when, but they were on a job and he had gotten his phone wet. He tried some home remedies, but they didn't fix it. So he put it in Henry's glove box and just gave it to him. It was a prepaid phone that still had minutes on it, he believed. On cross, Silas said that when Henry was shooting the crossbow, he couldn't do it well and kept missing the target. He couldn't hold the bow straight. He said that after Henry had been shot in July of 2010, he was limited and couldn't do his full work. Vance Wiggins manages the child support program with the Florida Department of Revenue. Wiggins showed the jury a series of letters that were sent to Henry regarding his child support for Javonte. One letter stated he owed $19,356.22. On June 29, 2010, Henry wrote a letter to Child Support Services saying he has, quote, "strong evidence to support that this child is not mine. I have been told on a number of occasions that this child is not mine by his mother, as well as recorded voicemail messages from the mother stating this. I am disputing the paternity of said child. No order of support should be issued until the issue of definitive paternity is addressed. I am requesting my due process concerning the matter of paternity." The month before the murders, Child Support Services sent Henry another letter saying that if he doesn't pay his child support, his driver's license could be suspended, he could get a negative credit rating, and a lien could be put on any real estate that he owns. On November 3rd, 2010, 16 days before the murders, A final notice was sent to Henry, stating that he could go to jail if he doesn't pay. Reagan said that in November 2010, in the days and weeks leading up to the murder, Child Support Services had begun the process of suspending Henry's driver's license and welding license. Wiggins agreed with prosecutors that if Javonte was deceased, Henry would not have to pay back the child support. He said Brandy contacted their contact center on November 17, 2010, 2 days before the murders, to check on the status of her case against Henry. Joellen Brown, a now retired crime scene laboratory analyst with the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, testified that foreign DNA was found throughout Brandy's home, as well as underneath Brandy's fingernails. DNA that did not match Henry Segura or any of the victims. She said foreign DNA was found on the interior deadbolt of the front door, on the exterior door handle, and in the bathtub where the children's bodies were found. Foreign female DNA was found underneath Brandy's fingernails and on the interior front door deadbolt. The DNA found on the grab bar inside the bathtub was a partial mixture that included the victims. She said DNA markers from there were similar to Henry's, but she couldn't say definitively one way or another. There was no determination for Henry Segura, she said. But with about 200 samples submitted in this case, she agreed with the defense that Henry Segura was not included as a contributor.
There were something like 200 samples submitted to you in total in this case, correct?
Roughly. Yes. I didn't count them, but yes.
And Mr. Segura, other than his own buckle swab, Mr. Segura was not included as a contributor, meaning that you were not able to identify him as a contributor to any one of these mixtures, correct?
That's correct.
Sergeant Chris Corbett testified about text messages Brandy sent to Henry on Tuesday, November 16th, 2010. At 7:44 a.m., she wrote, "Your mama da bitch, and I'm going to wait till y'all taxes. I'm calling to IRS and telling them that y'all live together so I can get both of y'all money, LOL." Then, 2 minutes later, she wrote, "I'm going to call them in the morning, so don't pay, your ass will be in jail. You don't have to text back, but I'm going to see you in court. I'm calling them." Henry then forwarded the text messages to his wife. Dr. Kevin McElfresh was one of the last witnesses to testify for the state. He specializes in forensic DNA analysis, particularly in DNA mixtures. Dr. McElfresh was hired by the state to examine that DNA sample taken from the bath bar in the bathtub where the children were found. As you'll recall, the state's witness from the FDLE had testified that she was unable to either include or exclude Henry from that sample. The defense argued in their opening statements that the sample could have come from Javonte and not Henry. Dr. McElfresh testified that the DNA contained a mixture from Brandy, Tamaya, Tanaya, and Henry. He said Javonte's DNA was not there. He said the DNA mixture is 700 billion times more likely to come from those individuals than anyone else in the world. Prosecutors played a jailhouse phone call for the jury between Henry and his wife from September 4th, 2011. In it, Henry talks about how he's in love with another woman and wants to be with her when he gets out. His wife is devastated and tells him that she has no money, bad credit, and nowhere to go. She says, "Whatever. All I know is I gave up my life for you and you chose someone else, and now I've got to find me a new life." Henry responds, "Well, it's looking like I gave up mine for you." The prosecution rested their case, and then the defense's case started. Will the testimony of James Carlos Santos, the drug trafficker with the cartel, who the defense says ordered Brandy's murder, be credible on the stand?
At some point, did you end up directing associates of yours to kill Brandy Peters?
Yes, sir, I did.
And why was that?
She had stolen money and drugs.
And what about Henry Segura himself?
You told your attorney that you didn't commit these murders.
I told the world I didn't commit these murders.
Okay. Well, why wouldn't you?
You say, why wouldn't I?
Right.
Because I have no reason whatsoever to kill my son or those twins. Neither Brandy.
I'll be releasing part two next week. Let me know what you think so far on Instagram at Court Junkie, on Twitter at Court Junkie Pod, or by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.